Hello and welcome to the Straight to the Source podcast. I'm Tanya Barr.
And I'm Lucy Allen, and we're looking forward to taking you straight to the source of the people driving our food and hospitality industry forward. Today's guest is Chef Alex Pritchard, whose career has taken him through some of Australia's most acclaimed kitchens, including Momofuku Siebo, Sake and The Cut. He then moved on to work at Iceberg's Dining Room and Bar, where he became head chef at just 24. And since then, he's built a reputation for championing local producers, sustainable cooking, and ingredient-led dining. Now, he's preparing to open Sara, a highly anticipated farm and destination dining venture on the New South Wales South Coast. Today, we're going to dive into why he's stepping away from city dining to build something more grounded and produce-driven, what hospitality looks like in Australia right now, and what Michelin's arrival in South Australia could mean for the future of the industry. Alex, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Tanya and I have been wanting to get you in on the podcast for a really long time, but I feel like the timing is perfect now because you've just made a big announcement about your move from Bondi to Bury.
Yeah, I'm glad you waited.
Yeah, exactly. So look, I'm going to start off, I think, by focusing in on what this new chapter really means for you. And so after more than a decade, I think it's been at Icebergs, why was now the moment to leave what many would consider one of Australia's most iconic restaurants to build something on a farm in Bury?
I suppose it's something I always wanted to do. Obviously, I've been at Icebergs for quite a long time, but my wife and I and now our family, we moved down to the South Coast maybe 6 years ago. So for the last 6 years, I've been commuting from 2.5 hours south to Icebergs. If anything, that tells you the draw and how amazing Icebergs is to work at, that I'd commute 2.5 hours every day one way, so 5 hour round trip, just to keep working there for the last 6 years. So absolutely loved Bergs and loved being there and everything it's given me. But when you kind of have kids and a young family, you need to be present a little bit more, I suppose. And then I've always been drawn to the idea of wanting to do a regional restaurant, and especially, you know, a farm to table restaurant. And I've worked with you for so long, you know how much I love producers and everything they do. And I kind of nerd out a bit on understanding, you know, how they do everything.
So,
it's always been a dream. And then there were a few false starts. Like, I think probably the start of COVID, I told all the directors from Icebergs, like, my dream is to open my own regional restaurant, and I'm going to be pursuing that.
At the beginning of COVID?
Yep.
Okay. So, yeah. Like, six years ago.
Yeah, probably about a year after we moved down south. Okay. I gave it 12 months to go. Can we actually live here and do we like it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I kind of said, hey, I'm going to be trying to do this. And then I think there were a few false starts, and nothing felt quite right until Linnaeus Collection came along, basically.
So what is your vision for Sara Dining and Garden?
So I suppose it starts, there's a backstory behind it. Linnaeus Collection, Peter and Nadia, my partners in the restaurant, own Linnaeus Collection, which is essentially a hotel reimagined. It's basically what you'd consider a deconstructed hotel, if you will. So there's 7 different accommodations, all within kind of like a 5-minute drive of each other, 2 of which are on farms, kind of 2 minutes down the road from each other. So everything's within kind of a 5-minute drive of the town centre of Bury.
Right.
But we've got 7 different accommodations that can sleep up to, I think it's 65 to 70 people.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. And then so 2 of those houses are on kind of 10-acre farms, one of them being at Maria Farm. Oh, one more bit of backstory. Linnaeus Collection, named after Carl Linnaeus, the naming system for basically all living things. So within the Linnaeus Collection is named after something to do with Carl Linnaeus.
Okay.
His wife's maiden name was Sara Maria. So Maria Farm was named after his wife's maiden last name, and Sara's named after his wife's first name, which was kind of the grounding force and the center of his life, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you found the property, what was it that felt right about this property? You said you kind of nothing had felt right before. What was it that clicked here?
I loved that it felt rural, but it was 5 minutes from the beach. Mm. So there was this natural kind of mix where I felt like I was on a farm, but I also didn't feel weird about serving seafood.
Okay.
Because we're still so close to the ocean.
Yep.
So it ticked a couple boxes there, and then to be honest. Like, the properties are amazing and beautiful, and the collection themselves are incredible. But Peter and Nadia, when Ange, my wife, and I first met them, we just went, nah, these guys are amazing at what they do. And we had a mutual respect for each other's, I suppose, talents or fields of work. And, yeah, the partnership just felt right. And then, yeah, it's like it kind of naturally progressed. I started off just kind of consulting for Pete and Nards and showing them, you know, how to kind of build the restaurant, what I think would be best for it. And then it slowly morphed to, hey, this is kind of 80% of the way there to something I'd really want to do. Why don't we just rip the Band-Aid off, go the further 20%, and I'll be in on it with you, and we'll do it all together.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to be sort of involved in overseeing the restaurant and the garden,
yeah,
the farm,
yep,
and the hotel will be something that they'll oversee, but then that partnership is bringing that all together.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So the hotel and a comm is what Linear's Collection and mm-hmm. Peter and Nadia and Carly as well are, you know, phenomenal at doing that. And,
yep,
you know, I'd be horrible at that even, you know, trying to organise the amount of bed sheets and linen and stuff. Not my world. But where I come into it is kind of the last missing piece of the collection was the food and beverage offering. Mm-hmm. If you consider a traditional hotel, they've got all the marks of it. You know, every single room has its own ensuite. They're built incredible. They're beautiful. The grounds are amazing. There's pools. There's wellness facilities, pool, sauna, spa, massages, turn down service, everything. The last thing that was missing was an F&B offering. So that's where I kind of come in, where we've got Sara Dining and Garden, the restaurant itself, and then that will also have a food and beverage offering to all of the individual accommodations. So yep, much like a hotel, like if you're staying in one of the houses, you can click on a QR code, order what we've got called the poolside menu, which is basically like a room service menu.
Mm-hmm.
You can also have a private chef come and cook a full dinner in your house as well.
Okay. Yeah. So not a small undertaking.
No.
With a young family.
Yeah.
But obviously, I know, you know, this connection to the land, to produce, is something you're incredibly passionate about. You know, we've worked for many years on the Delicious Produce Awards together, for which you're both a state and national judge. And so I guess, you know, it's a very intentional move. What is your role going to be? Are you going to be mainly in the kitchen and you've got a team on the farm, or are you doing it all?
It's a mix, to be honest with you. I'm lucky that I've ended up with incredible people. So I've got some amazing people in Lewin and Bosley that are in the kitchen. Then I've also got, you know, Caleb and Aaron out in the garden. There's a host of other people that help look after the property. So I suppose where I fit in is wherever I'm needed at the time. Mm-hmm. My end goal with it is hopefully to get to a point where if I come into work, I'm not needed anywhere, and I can go, if I feel like cooking today, I can cook. If I feel like going around and planting seeds all day, I can do that. If I feel like just taking guests on tours around the farm and showing them what we do, that's what I can do.
Okay.
Hopefully, fingers crossed.
So that kind of culinary director role where you're just bringing it all together.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And so you mentioned when we were chatting earlier that for the last 12 months you have been very involved in the farm side of it.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, what you've been doing and how that's going to inform what you're going to be doing in the restaurant and on the menu.
So since Ange and I moved down south, we've had like a pretty extensive garden at home, and I've played around with a bunch of things, some of which, you know, will kind of grow to an extent that I could take some into icebergs and things like that. But, you know, I learned a lot, and mm-hmm. I stuffed a lot up as well.
Yeah.
And luckily I was close enough to a lot of different farmers and producers that I could call them for advice or
Help.
Send them photos of things and go, what did I do wrong here? Why is this doing this? What's going on? So I'm lucky that I've had that kind of background before moving into this kind of what you consider, I suppose, a market garden size.
Mm.
So I kind of know what works and what doesn't. And then for the last 12 months, we've been able to, on that farm, kind of play around with what grows, what doesn't, what works where. I mean, we are small in terms of the acreage and also the land, because it still is an accommodation that needs to look pretty. So
yep,
it's not just a completely functioning farm that's got, you know, tractor rows tilled in. We've got what we call kind of the pretty garden, which is 10 metres from where you're kind of sitting, and that's where we grow what you consider, I guess, high rotation crops,
yep,
like things like lettuces, leaf lines, going into winter, all your brassicas and stuff like that.
Yep.
Then we've got what we call the ugly garden, which is kind of a patch down the back that goes a bit wild. So like over the summer, we'd have like melons and cucumbers and stuff in there that would go a bit crazy. Mm-hmm. Now that we're getting into winter, we've got like long form radishes and different varieties of peas and stuff like that. Then we've built like a giant berm down one side that's perfect for natives because it's kind of built up and it's got incredible drainage. So the whole top of that's filled with edible natives. And then either side, we've got kind of even uglier and longer things. So like one side, it's completely full of like different onion varieties and elephant garlic and stuff like that, stuff that would take up a lot of time and space in the pretty garden. And then on the back side of that berm, that's where we're growing kind of all of our berry varieties because they look beautiful, you know, for a couple months. Then they've got to be covered in fruit nets. And then over the winter, they go back to cane. So they look ugly.
Yeah, they're all very brambly.
So we've kind of got this. It took a bit of juggling around, to be honest, to get the right balance between aesthetically pleasing and operationally efficient.
Yeah, I can imagine. And so what was your biggest learning over the last 12 months? Like what, for example, did you think would be a no-brainer and didn't work?
So much. A lot. I underestimated the impact the weather has when you're trying to grow things at scale.
Right.
Like melons was the most true sign of it. Like I'd grown a couple melons at home, but we're talking like one or two plants and like maybe four or five melons and I'd eat them. I'd be like, this is the best melon I've ever had. This is amazing. I'm a genius. And then trying to grow them in scale in a field and you've got like, a pretty rainy summer and then huge amounts of heat. Then you've got kind of mold growing and things like that. Mm-hmm. I left for like a week and a half and I came back and they were all just ruined.
Wow. So a real newfound appreciation for what producers are doing on a sort of daily, weekly, annual basis, subject to the weather, trying to grow at scale so that they've got a financially viable business.
It's crazy. And like we were pretty lucky with that was just going to be a crop that we were going to save for seed or just eat ourselves anyway.
Yeah.
But it did really make me consider, okay, cool, if I've put all my eggs into this particular dish being on a menu and I'm trying to grow something for it and it doesn't work, what am I going to do?
Mm.
Like hypothetically, if I'd never done that test and I was dead set that, hey, this summer we're going to have, hemon and melon on or something with these incredible Chanterelle melons and then they stuffed up, I would just be like, well, what am I going to do now? Like I planned that's been sold on menus, people have booked to have it, whatever. So it kind of taught me that I need to be a little bit more flexible in my approach to food and
And menu planning.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so I think you've mentioned that you're going to be growing about 80% of the produce for the restaurant. What will you need to source to complement that?
I think, and I wanted to be honest with everyone from the start about it, that 80% for me I feel is achievable and realistic and I'm comfortable with it. To say we'd do 100% is insane. Like to try and grow every onion and every carrot that we'd ever use in stock would just be ridiculous. And also the realities of like, if a corporate customer books in a breakfast event and they want avo on toast, I'm not going to turn around to them and go, nah, sorry, we've only got pumpkin. There's the commercial realities of running a business that I also needed to factor in. And that's kind of what that 20% is that, if someone comes to us and they go, hey, we want to do this particular event or there's this particular activation or theme or something like that and I can't manage to grow everything, I want the freedom to be able to go, okay, cool, I can't do that. I don't have that currently. Let me source it from someone I know or someone that I know cares as much as we do.
Yep.
And get what I can,
No, that makes sense. And so I guess that makes me think about how do you define then the term local in that, in the ingredients that you will be sourcing outside of what you're growing?
I suppose it ties to not 100% of the menu is ever going to be local. Like, and that's one thing that I've been really important to share in both the media and the menu planning and everything like that. Like the best example of it is this mixed crudo plate we've got.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, some incredible royal red prawns from Bombo, 20 minutes north of us. It's got Craig Lukey's blue mackerel, tuna, wild kingfish, but then it's also got Chris Bolton's coral trout and Paspaley pearl meat on it.
Okay.
And, those two things come from quite a fair distance away, but they're two beautiful products. I know the people that produce them. I know them well. I've used them for years and I love them. I don't want to hold back my customers from being able to eat and enjoy them. To me, that would be not the best use of I suppose my skills, but also I feel like regional diners often miss out on some of those luxuries of Sydney, if you will. Like I can't think of the last time I went to a regional restaurant and got to enjoy crisp Alton coral trout.
Yeah.
And the reality is it's actually not that hard. Like in the same way that Chris flies it from Cairns to Sydney and I pick it up from the airport for icebergs, there's a truck going from Ulladulla Fisherman's Co-op to Sydney and back every single day. So there's no difference in the timeline of it going from, you know, the airport in Mascot to icebergs as opposed to the airport in Mascot to Berry.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So I think your intention then is to make it very connected to the land and to the destination, but then also to really reflect the best of Australian produce as much as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way of summing it up. I wish you wrote my media release.
Well, I could always help you with the next one. So does that sort of level of dependency on nature, has it made you think really differently about the way you write a menu and engage in that whole process of planning the business?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think the biggest thing that's changed is probably my idea of the aesthetics of food.
Mm.
Like when I'd traditionally come up with a dish at Icebergs, I would go, okay, cool, this is delicious. I love how it tastes. All right, how do we make it look a way that we want it to aesthetically look? And often that'll be with, you know, incredible, beautiful garnishes or something like that, that, you know, we're lucky enough to communicate with an amazing grower on and go, okay, cool, how many of these can you do a week? How many weeks are we going to have them for, et cetera? I don't necessarily have that luxury there that, you know, I've got growers I can fall back on, but I'm trying to avoid it if I can.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I put pea flowers on a dish and then my pea crop fails, I can't be solely tied to that as an idea. So I think it's loosened up my idea of what the aesthetics of dishes need to be a little bit.
Right, okay.
And especially when a lot of those kind of finer garnish things and flowers, they typically are grown in tunnels and stuff like that, which I don't have. So I really am at the behest of nature a bit.
Yeah, okay. So you're really moving from, you know, I guess a sense of luxury city dining and having access to incredible produce from around Australia to very land-driven dining and having to really adapt to that. Has it made you think that that chefs need to focus more on really reconnecting with the source more deeply?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it would be good for every chef to have to experience what it's like to grow something. Like the easiest example I can think of is a bunch of chives. Most chefs get, like, you know, a market bunch of chives from their providore and it kind of shows up and the majority of chefs will leave, you know, chop off the ends and then leave a couple inches down the bottom and they just go in the bin. Whereas when you're going out and you're having to kind of cut the chives with a set of scissors in the garden and you're bringing them back and they're not all perfect and you've kind of got to filter through the different tips and stuff like that and slice them.
Mm.
And then you know, oh, okay, if I don't get the exact amount of chives I need out of this, I've got to go back out to the garden. It's going to take me another 10 minutes to harvest more. So you're really trying to make the most out of it.
Mm. Different thought process.
Yeah, it's definitely a different thought process. I think it's a great thing for chefs to know what goes into, especially young chefs. If they can be educated on how much goes into the products they're using, they might appreciate them a little bit more. And also, I think for the general consumer, might appreciate the cost of things a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, it's easy to go, a cabbage costs $2 at Woolworths, but not every cabbage is the same.
Yeah. And it's that value proposition, is it's really understanding what's gone into growing it and getting it to the kitchen, to the table.
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, your transition and, you know, the opening of Sara is a real... it's part of a bigger movement that I think is happening in Australia, where chefs are really, they're rethinking their approach to produce on the plate and leaving cities and building more sort of destinations and regional areas. Do you think that's a trend? Do you see that as a trend? Was that influencing what you were thinking, or this was just something you felt really personal and passionate about?
I think so. I think, look, people are a victim of, you know, kind of the housing crisis in Sydney and how expensive everything is. We saw it in Newcastle a number of years ago. Like 15 years ago, if you talked about dining out in Newcastle, there'd be next to nothing. Now you talk about dining out in Newcastle and it's a dining destination itself. And what that was kind of 10, 12 years ago, there was this huge influx of kind of young families and people, you know, migrating up to Newcastle from Sydney. Some of them had incredible hospital experience in Sydney and they took that knowledge. They went to Newcastle, opened a bunch of things up. They then taught and trained local chefs who then go on to open things up. And it kind of pollinates this entire micro industry in a region. And I think that's slowly going to happen across regional New South Wales as, you know, people transition through the industry and they get to a point in their life where they go, okay, I need to be able to buy a home. Unless I want $1 million salary, I'm not really going to be able to buy a home in Bondi. So, all right, where can I go where I can still do what I love and there's people there that are willing to pay for my product?
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm hoping it slowly does pollinate out. Nothing would make me happier than, you know, if Sarah's a huge success and, you know, we're still around in 10 years' time, then seeing people that have worked with me over the years there go on to open their own things in the region.
Yeah.
And do incredible work there. I think that'd be beautiful.
It definitely feels like there's more and more coming into the market. I mean, Three Blue Ducks have just opened up Burradoo Park Farm.
It's a huge success. I just saw that you're having to buy a ticket to go there on the weekend.
Yes. Well, I was lucky enough to be down there a couple of weekends ago. And, you know, what they've established there is incredible.
It's good for kids as well to
exactly,
see.
Exactly, yeah.
And parents as well, anyone that comes really. And, like, that's one thing that I really loved. And when we first moved down to Gerringong, I did a series of pop-ups at a place called Dovecot, like a luxury accommodation there.
Mm.
And one thing that I loved was that people, when they came to these kind of pop-up lunches and dinners we were putting on, because it was in a house, not a restaurant, people weren't treating it like a restaurant. Mm. You know, when you go to a restaurant and you're stuck in your kind of 3 or 4 square meters, I really loved that between courses, people would be going up and they'd be exploring the house, or they'd be hanging out in the garden. People would be, you know, having a cigarette or a cocktail outside and talking, intermingling. And I love that. And it's something that I isolated from those events that I went, okay, whenever I open a regional restaurant, that's what I want to be able to repeat. So, like, when you come to Sarah and you've had a huge meal, but you still want dessert, but you're stuffed, cool, let's go for a walk around the garden, have a little Amara or a coffee. We'll walk around the garden, do a tour, pop back to your table and it'll be ready. Or if you come with your family and, you know, the kids are getting a bit stir crazy, cool, we're on a farm, there's not a road there, cool, run around, go play with the goats, go over there and see them, whatever.
Yeah. And they've got a Stephanie Alexander kitchen garden as well, which is fantastic. So that real sort of, like you said, the education for children is really, really important. And it makes me feel like restaurants are kind of moving away from feeling like status symbols to more experiential opportunities. You know, people really take their time and immerse themselves in it, which is equally as exciting, because I think it is people walk away with a different experience and a different meaning of food.
Yeah, definitely.
So hospitality as an industry it's under enormous pressure right now, you know, economically, labor costs, produce costs, overheads, you know, margins are shrinking. It's a reality. What does it feel like opening a venue in this kind of economic climate? Is that something that worries you? Have you considered that, or you're just all your boots in?
I've got a really funny story for you on that. Just straight after the announcement of me leaving Icebergs came out, Bianca, who I know really well, is an amazing journalist. She wrote the me leaving Iceberg story for Good Food. Then a week later, she did a story on the amount of regional restaurants in New South Wales that are closing.
Yeah.
And I shared the story to her. I went, maybe I'm just an idiot. And she was lovely and she had these amazing words of support for me. But I definitely did have that passing thought going, this is scary. I mean, I suppose I'm lucky in a way that the project we've taken on has multiple facets to it, in that there's an econ business. There's something more than just coming to eat food and drink, I suppose. And I think we've really considered what the challenges that a lot of regional dining places face, one of which being alcohol. If you're a regional dining in your destination, there's not Uber.
There's
rarely a taxi in a regional town.
Yeah.
So 50% of your clients can't really drink, assuming two people are coming in a car, whatever. So look, we've been really, really considerate of that. And the Bev team I'm working with, we've made it so that every single cocktail on the list also has a non-alcoholic option.
Yep.
And we've also teamed up with Volkswagen to get some electric combi vans so that we can ferry people from the town and their comms to and from the restaurant.
Right, okay. So and you'll manage that for your customers.
For the guests. So we isolated that's one challenge that I think regional restaurants face is the spend on booze versus Sydney.
Yeah.
And so we've put a couple things in place to hopefully combat it. But it's a challenging time for the industry all around. And I feel now more than ever, restaurants need to have what you consider an X factor or a point of difference, or be incredibly smart operators. Like, I'm seeing more and more chefs and restaurateurs now that are going direct to producer to try and save markups when they can. You're seeing, you know, restaurant groups now more than ever going direct to the fish markets or Flemington markets where they can to try and save those dollars. And it's it's taking a huge amount of effort from them, but you're seeing people pivot and do those things to try and try and claw back a bit of that margin that we lose.
Yeah, well, I mean, business models are having to adapt, aren't they? They're having to think differently and they're having to be a lot more thoughtful of those costs that might be able to be managed better. And I guess growing everything or 80% of what you're going to be using on the farm is going to be a big benefit in that sense. But then that comes with its own overheads and management. So it's kind of like, I don't know, do you feel like, obviously, as you mentioned, alcohol, people having to drive, you having to sort of think of a solution to get people backwards and forwards. Are there any other sort of pressures that you think regional hospitality venues face that are very different to cities?
I think attracting people to the regions is definitely one. Like we're lucky that we're a 2-hour drive from Sydney. So if you finish work on a Friday arvo, for those people that still do work in an office on Fridays, you can jump in the car, get down there by kind of 7, check in, have a dinner and still enjoy the weekend and then head home Sunday afternoon and you're still good. If we were 4 hours away, that'd be problematic. Like, you know, someone leaving Sydney at 5 p.m., getting out there maybe 9 p.m., 10, then having to leave first thing Sunday morning, that's a different predicament. So I'm conscious that while we're regional, we're still, you know, you can go back and forth from there in a day if you really wanted to. If you want to just pop down for lunch from Sydney, you can.
Yeah.
I feel for those people that are further out. It's hard to draw people out, especially just for a weekend. And there's all kinds of challenges that face, like, you know, we saw just then with all the drama on in the Middle East and the rising fuel prices, people were staying in Australia more than heading over to Europe. Everyone in regional hospitality saw this huge influx, you know, kind of during COVID, of people traveling to the regions because they couldn't go overseas. It's interesting the problems that face it and how incredibly up and down it is. Like,
you know, your experience at Icebergs is it was such an iconic destination that you didn't probably really have to think too much about drawing people in. You just had to manage to continue to give them an incredible experience. But now I think that sort of that destination marketing piece is going to become so much more important to keep that sort of, you know, constant flow of business coming through. And marketing, is that something that really businesses have to drive? Or do you feel like you're going to be able to lean on destination marketing organizations to help with that?
No, you've got to constantly drive. But the other part of it as well as like tourists, which is such a huge focus for businesses, I think one thing some regional venues do miss out on is doing something for the locals. As much as tourists are your bread and butter, your locals are what keep the lights on.
Yeah.
You know, and that's also something we identified and we're conscious about. So we've done certain things where, like, you know, if locals book for, I think it's up to 4 people or something, there's a percentage off their bill, you know, Monday to Friday.
Yep.
Or, you know, if they book a group for, you know, their birthday or anniversary or whatever, like a large group, we'll automatically upgrade them from a 2-course menu to a 3.
Yeah.
Stuff like that to try and say to locals, hey, this isn't just targeted at tourists, we're also here to service you as well. And then also past that, I think especially in regional areas, it's really hard to find somewhere to go just for a snack or a drink in the arvo or any time of day. Most places are just open dinner or lunch. One thing we were conscious of, and I could be an idiot for it, like a few people have said there's a reason why no one does this, is A, being open Mondays, and then B, we open from midday and that's just it. If you want to roll in at 3 p.m. and have, you know, a glass of wine and a few snacks in the garden before, you know, the kids get home from school or whatever, or, you know, you do have a young family and you want to just pop in and have dinner at 5 p.m., sure, go for it. So I think that's something we've been conscious of as well. Those times are probably times that locals and tourists alike are missing out on something.
Yeah, and it gives people the confidence to not have to think, oh, is it open? Should I check? Just get in the car. We know it's going to be open. So, you know, they'll have more confidence in coming to visit.
Yeah.
I guess that whole sort of topic, the reason I was thinking about it was, you know, obviously it's been in the press in the last sort of 6 months that Tourism Australia turned down the Michelin guide. And there's been a lot of different opinions around that, which I didn't necessarily want to get into right now. But I do want to know, now that you are in a regional dining destination, do you think that was a right or a wrong decision? Because, of course, in the last few days, South Australia have just announced that they have got the Michelin guide coming to South Australia.
Yeah, look, I think it's incredible. I think it's I sent a number of chefs over in South Australia, no congrats messages. It's amazing for them because, you know, they've often missed out on that kind of coverage we're lucky enough to get in New South Wales and Victoria of a kind of dining guide, whether or not that's going to lead to new people coming. Like, I don't know how many tourists are overseas going, oh, Australia just got a one-star restaurant. We need to travel to Australia now to go there. I'm not too sure on how that's going to pan out, to be honest with you. I do think it's great for places that didn't have a guide to be able to have something that kind of easily assembles things into a recognisable category, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I don't know, say tomorrow New South Wales announced they were, Tourism New South Wales or whatever announced they were doing it for New South Wales, even if I got a star down there or whatever their other metric is, I don't believe it would be a dial changer for us.
Mm.
Like, unless we were the only restaurant in the state to get one, maybe then.
Yeah.
But if you're in a sea of other one-star restaurants, I don't necessarily see it being a huge dial changer or bringing people from overseas.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you heard, and I can't remember whether I read it in an article or maybe in the book, Bray experienced a huge amount of influx from being in the top 50 of people from overseas traveling to, you know, Melbourne and Victoria just to be able to go to Bray, which I think's incredible and amazing. So it is obvious that some guides or some lists do definitely have an impact on people. But I think, yeah, I think being in the top 50 restaurants in the world versus obtaining a star probably have different impacts, I think.
Yeah, I'm in your camp. I totally agree with what you've just said. And I guess what do you in that sense then of thinking, you know, what we do so well and what guides can or can't influence, is there anything that you hope Australia never loses in our dining scene as it gets more global attention?
I hope we never lose the ability to be deeply Australian and a bit egalitarian. You know, I'd hate the idea that every single incredible Aussie restaurant needs to get that little bit stiffer or needs to have perfectly starched tablecloths to have a rating that equals business. Because the reality is there's not a single business owner, myself included, that if that was a dial changer wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
We don't have tablecloths, but if I thought that was going to be a dial changer for revenue and I was suffering, you watch me go and iron tablecloths every day. So, yeah, I just hope if they come here, they understand that, you know, while Icebergs has tablecloths on in winter, we take them off in summer because it's light, it's breezy, it's fresh, we're by the ocean. That's what feels natural and normal in that environment. I don't want Australian restaurants, chefs, restaurateurs, whatever, feeling constricted by those criteria.
Those kind of rules, yeah.
Yeah, those rules.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think what Australia does so well in dining, whether it's at the top end or casual, is that it sets its own agenda.
Yeah.
And it's very honest about what it is, and it's very based on place and that experience. And I think that's what we do so, so well.
I also worry that overseas guides, I suppose, wouldn't have the knowledge of the limitations Australia faces.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing reviewing a restaurant in France or Asia or the US or somewhere where wages and rent are a completely different proportion to running a restaurant in Sydney.
Yep.
Where in a lot of those overseas restaurants, you can afford to have 20 chefs on in a kitchen. You can afford to spend $1 million on a Maltini stove because your rent isn't also $1 million a year.
Yeah.
You know, I think the propositions and the criteria for restaurants overseas are very different to Australia.
Yeah.
And I feel like reviewers in Australia, at least for the most part, kind of understand some of the difficulties restaurants face across the board and go, okay, cool. We know you can't have 20 chefs on to perfectly place 45 tiny flowers on a dish amazingly. We understand that's not the reality of a restaurant unless it's a restaurant that's propped up by some other kind of business that allows that restaurant to lose money.
Yep. And I think also people underestimate the distance, and so the size of Australia and the distance produce needs to travel if it's traveling interstate or, you know, coast to coast. So that's something that I don't think anyone understands until they're here and they get a sense of the vastness of Australia.
And that wage and like rent trickle on, it has the same effect down to producers.
Mm.
Like, ultimately, if you go to like a fruit and veg market over in Europe, you see all this incredible stuff and you go, oh, why don't we have this in Australia? Or why don't we have that? And then you chat to a producer about it and you start to understand that, A, there's an insane cost to be able to import any type of new seed or new variety to Australia. Then you've got the risk of it just not working in our climate or the soil or anything like that. Then you've got all the environmental risks. Like when margins are already thin, it is very, very hard to convince any kind of farmer to take a gamble on doing something completely new or nuanced that hasn't been done before, because there's a huge investment of cost that they could very, very really never get back. Or on the off chance it works, how long is it going to take and how many of those units they're going to sell to claw it back?
Yeah.
So absolutely. I think there is also a limit in terms of produce we have to work with, the same way that we've got incredible things that the world's now taken and loved, like finger limes as an example. We also don't have some things the rest of the world has. So, I think understanding that wage thing trickles down to producers as well and what we're able to source.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very good point. Well, we're going to wrap up with a quick fire round. what are you most excited about for the menu at Sarah Dining?
I love crudo. So the mixed crudo plate's amazing. My arch nemesis on the menu is this omelette. There's a crab omelette on the menu. And it's an old school chef thing where and doing a perfect omelette is a sign of being a good chef. You know how to do it, and there's so few ingredients in there that if you do it perfectly, it shows that you really care and you've honed in on it. My wife's sick of eating omelettes. We have 8 chickens at home just so I don't have to buy all the eggs I've been testing omelettes with. I'm still not perfect at it, but hopefully we'll get there.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to tasting the crab omelette when I come down. What's the most underrated Australian ingredient right now?
Blue mackerel.
Okay. Well, that might feed into my next question. Who's a South Coast producer more people should know about?
Craig Lukey, that does the blue mackerel, is obviously pretty incredible. I think Greg Mum from Kangaroo Valley Retired Dairy Cow, pretty amazing as well. And then these Bombo prawns we just nominated for the Produce Awards, I love them. Okay. I love that they're named after Bombo Beach. Best train station in Australia. It's right on the beach. It's amazing. Okay.
One thing Australia does better than anywhere else food-wise?
Coastal dining, I feel. In Australia, I feel like everywhere by the ocean seems to nail that feeling of light, fresh, vibrant food I can eat and dive in the ocean after. Yeah.
It's pretty unique, yeah. One hospitality trend you're completely over?
Every chef that just puts barramundi or farmed salmon on their menu because it's easy and constantly available.
Good call. What do you hope people will feel the first time they eat at Sarah?
I hope they feel like they've come over to my place and they just happen to be sitting on my veranda, but there's someone doing the dishes and serving them. I want people to feel comfortable. I want people to feel like they can get up and explore. And, I want people to feel like they've been welcomed and welcomed into essentially our home.
It's a true essence of hospitality.
Yeah.
And what does going straight to the source mean to you?
Going straight to the source to me means knowing the name of the person that's grown everything I've done and knowing a little bit about not only them as a person, but their business, their challenges, how they do it, and being able to ultimately explain to other people how they do it.
Mm.
Nothing gives me more pleasure than someone asking me about a bit of produce we use. And I watch the look on their face when I get into this weird trance where I go back to that moment or time that I was with that producer and I walk them through every single detail. And I love it. I love knowing what goes into it. I love knowing the challenges that people face. And, I love that I'm actually in a position to be able to hopefully support some.
Mm, I was going to say, I think, your passion for that has really come through in everything that you've done at Icebergs. And I have no doubt it's going to be the shining light of Sarah Dining. But I think, your support for producers and really proactively finding ways to make sure you can keep them on the menu and you can keep that sort of seasonality reflected in your food, but in a way that really reflects what they do as well. So being able to adapt to their, challenges, be it to do with weather or fuel or whatever it might be. But I think that's been such a stamp of who you are as a chef. And I think that's very exciting for your next chapter.
I think it's also important just to remember they're humans. Like when you meet someone and you see what they do, and they send you a message and they just go, mate, I haven't been able to fish for 2 months now. The weather's been horrible, blah, blah, blah. And they might have a huge run of some type of fish you don't necessarily want to use, but you know them as a person. You know the challenges they've faced. And you go, okay, usually I just say no because I don't necessarily need it or it's easy. But then you go, okay, no, this person really needs this. And I know them as a human and as a producer.
Mm.
how can I find a home for this? How can I alter what I'm doing slightly to help them out? The same way that, you know, if I've got a huge event or a last minute booking or something, they've always helped me out.
Yeah. And that's that real connection with the land, the source of what you're doing. And I think Tonya and I are so excited for your next chapter, and we can't wait to come down and visit you when you open.
Thank you. Can't wait to have you guys down.
Yeah, it's been great to have you in the studio. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening in. We really hope you enjoyed the conversation.
We would be keen to hear from you if you have a story to share or a topic that we should dive into.
Drop us a line. We always love hearing from you.